You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 11th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing. We're live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's programme, Haiti's political and security crisis prompts regional leaders to convene an emergency summit, but what can they do to stabilise the situation? After that...
Il refuse d'entendre les Français, qu'il insulte à chaque fois qu'il le peut.
France's far-right rising star, Jordan Bardella, says it's President Macron who refuses to listen and insults his country's people. We'll explore Bardella's impact. We'll also run through the day's newspapers before we take one more look at the Oscars and the big winner, Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer.
Movies are just a little bit over 100 years old. I mean, imagine being there 100 years into painting or theatre. We don't know where this incredible journey is going from here.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. We start the show with Haiti, where a political crisis has gone from bad to worse in recent weeks. Gangs have demanded the resignation of the country's prime minister, Ariel Henry, who remains outside of the country, while an emergency meeting of regional Caribbean leaders is being held today to try and restore some semblance of normalcy to a country that has seen precious little of it over the last few years. Dr. Christopher Sabatini is a senior fellow for Latin America at Chatham House, and he joins me now. Chris, before we get to this regional summit, what is the current situation in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince?
Right now, Chris, about 80% of Port-au-Prince is controlled by gangs. Those gangs have ramped up their attacks on police stations. They've attacked the airport, which is what in part thwarted the interim President Henri's return last week to the capital. Hospitals have shut down, and the U.S. just airlifted a lot of non-essential embassy personnel out of Port-au-Prince. So it's dire, and reports are that a number of the gangs are now attacking the government buildings, including the government palace.
So then is it just a matter of time, frankly, before they capture 100% of the capital?
Yes. The question is can some international response be cobbled together quickly and effectively enough to be able to prevent that? But yes, their designs are clearly on capturing the government itself. So we've moved from just being a failed state to now almost a tipping point to a criminal state.
Well, then let's look at this regional summit, the regional CARICOM summit. What's been happening there? What will be happening there today? What do they hope to achieve? Can they actually organize some kind of, well, emergency international force?
That's the question isn't so much what they can do, but whom they should appeal to and how they can do it collectively. The original plan, which was really half-hearted, was to put together a contingent of about 1,000 Kenyan troops and a few others from Benin and from the Caribbean with a rather vague UN endorsement. Something more has to go in place. You need troops now. It is really a civil war or almost a criminal takeover, battle-tested troops. So CARICOM in meeting, I think what they'll have to do is, you know, their own assembling of some force isn't going to be sufficient. What they need to do is make an appeal to the United Nations for a broader, more aggressive force to restore some semblance of stability and peace in the country.
But just tell us a little bit more about their role, what they've been doing so far. I mean, this has been a long-running crisis, even if it's kind of come to this tipping point now. Haiti's essentially been without a proper government since the assassination of its president. I mean, how have these regional nations been involved, if at all?
You know, quite frankly, they haven't. And the truth is that leadership should have really come from the United States and Canada. Canada is a large Haitian population, a Haitian-Canadian population. And the EU really shouldn't have been left up to the Caribbean and CARICOM countries to respond. This was always going to take a much more robust force than had been envisioned. And in fact, the original idea, which was cooked up in October of last year, again, as you say, it was late October last year, that was still 2 years after the assassination of Moise, was never going to be sufficient. You know, it was only going to be a force that barely would cover the country. Now, you know, and I think that was cooked up with the idea of hopefully this can patch it together and get the country to the next elections. And that was the plan. The truth is really since Haiti's democratic transition in 1986, or effectively 1988, with the first democratic elections after the Duvaliers, the goal has always been just to get Haiti to the next election, somehow hoping that that would signal and bring some form of consensus, cooperation and security. But it's never done that. And the Caribbean countries have been very well integrated into past peacekeeping missions, in particular in 94, 95, in which they led it, the MINUSTAH force later. But it's not going to be sufficient. It's going to take other big countries to do it. The hope is that as the Caribbean bloc or community, they can now make a broader appeal for basically more responsibility from the larger countries.
Well, I guess that's part of the point, isn't it, Chris? I mean, you say that the U.S., the European Union and others, Canada, need to get involved. But at the same time, I mean, do they need to give the Caribbean nations responsibility just for the credibility of it? I mean, Haiti is extremely skeptical at this point of any kind of foreign intervention. Who has the credibility to actually lead a force that could achieve something on the ground?
That's a good point, Chris. And of course, you know, failed missions, there have been two primarily, have been led by the U.S., the U.N., Canada, and Brazil. None of those really wanted to go back in. I do think giving it more of a Caribbean focus does help, although you have, you know, a country like the Dominican Republic, which has always had a problematic relation with Dominicans of Haitian descent. Racism runs deep against Haitians in the Dominican Republic. So it's not a homogenous group that is mobilizing on behalf of Haitians and Haiti as a nation. What is important, too, is I think CARICOM will be issuing some sort of statement asking for some interim government, that Henri does not return. Henri is deeply unpopular. He's, you know, his rise to power after the assassination of Moise was questionable. So I think what you're going to see is more of a political push and cover for a transition or interim type government that could lead to a broader, I hope, international force.
Well, and as you say, Prime Minister Henri is not popular the way that he has been leading, not running elections. He's kind of blamed that on the gangs, frankly, and said there's no ability for an election to be held. But at the same time, he is extremely unpopular. Is there any sense that you get that some kind of transitional government would have any more credibility, though, than he does, particularly with these gangs that are demanding his resignation?
It would have to be a coalition government. Again, Henri's accession to power, such as it was always under a shadow, given even that he had been sworn in as vice president just a few days before Moise was assassinated. And it would have to be more than just one person. You have no elected officials right now in Haiti. The parliament's mandate has been has expired and they've been dissolved. You need some sort of broader coalition of different opposition figures, and that needs to avoid the participation of any of the armed groups that are currently plaguing Port-au-Prince and the rest of the country. And so it has to be a civilian force, a clean civilian force, but one that represents as broad a spectrum as possible of civilian politicians.
Just finally and quickly, Chris, what did you make then of Guy Philippe, this guy who led a coup in 2004, returned from U.S. prison last year? He says he wants to be president.
Yeah, he's been running for president for a long time. He does want to be president. And in fact, you know, he's a former military officer, oddly enough, who went rogue, I guess you could say. Although he's now a criminal himself and served time in the United States for human trafficking, he has been advocating for a long time a iron fist approach to the security dilemma in Haiti. He would deliver that. But again, the man has all sorts of sinister, nefarious ties within the criminal subculture in Haiti, or now actually a sort of above ground culture in Haiti. So it would be an unwise choice. But in an open election, quite frankly, there's a good chance he could win.
Thanks very much, Chris. That was Christopher Sabatini. Now here's Emma Searle with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. Portugal's centre-right Democratic Alliance has claimed victory in yesterday's general election, but major gains by the far-right Chega may force the Democratic Alliance to form a minority government. The party has so far refused to negotiate with Chega. Russia has said it is willing to negotiate with Ukraine, responding to Pope Francis's controversial call for Ukraine to have the courage of the white flag and talk peace. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has said the Pope's intervention was quite understandable. Ukraine has said it will raise no flags other than its own blue and yellow. And Germany and France have backed a second term for Kristalina Georgieva to head the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C. Georgieva's term ends on September 30th, and the IMF managing director has said she would be honoured to serve another 5 years. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Emma. Now, the rise of far-right parties has been a continuing theme in Europe throughout this past year, along with an influx of new and charismatic populist leaders. Yesterday saw Portugal's far-right Chega party make huge strides, as you just heard in the headlines, and you can hear more about that on this morning's Globalist. But for this show, we'll focus on France, where a new poll shows that the Rassemblement National could win as much as 31% of the vote in European parliamentary elections slated for June. It's largely due to the rise of 28-year-old party leader Jordan Bardella. Political analyst Florence Biedermann joins me now from Paris for more on this. Florence, let's start with, France's far right, frankly, has been strong for quite a while, but also kept out of government. Could that be about to change?
Morning, Chris. Yes, certainly. This is the big worry now. With each election, it has been progressing under the leadership of Marine Le Pen, who has managed to demonize the party, to modernize it, let's say, to present it with a, let's say, smoother face. It is the first party by large in the polls for the European election. President Emmanuel Macron party comes with 18%, 13 points after that. So it's kind of a one-off, in French politics, because had the extreme right be so far ahead of a pro-European party in the European elections.
Well, and you talked about Marine Le Pen sort of moderating the party somewhat. How would they then approach the European Parliament if they are indeed the strongest force from France? How have their views on the European Union kind of evolved?
Well, it has evolved from let's get out of the euro, let's get out of the EU to, of course, much more moderate position. I say, of course, because when you are going, progressing towards power, you have some other ideas. So now Marine Le Pen proposed a kind of Europe of nations. That means not really the EU, with much stronger powers to each country. If you look at it, it could mean the end of the EU eventually. So that means she's really progressively not openly saying, let's leave the EU, but what she suggests is on the way to get out of the EU.
Is that, do you really feel, still kind of the goal there? I just wonder, it's as you say, it's always interesting how some far-right parties kind of moderate their image in order to become palatable for a government. Italy's Giorgia Meloni is an interesting example of that as well. But then others do stick to their guns. What is your sense of the case with Rassemblement National?
They definitely, their goal is not that much, about Europe and to win the European election. Their goal is to get the presidency. Marine Le Pen has faced twice Emmanuel Macron in two former contests. So now the French elections are in a few years, but still, this is definitely what she has in mind. And, she sticks still, to her guns on the classic traditional strong points of the extreme right, like insecurity, Islamism, national sovereignty. So she still had the same, let's say, mantra, but in a less aggressive way. So that's how she managed, to gain so many ground, and also based on the insatisfaction of the electorate toward Macron.
Well, and before we get to Macron, just quickly as well, you've focused a lot on Marine Le Pen. Obviously, understandably, she is the face. But there is also a new face within her party, this 28-year-old leader, Jordan Bardella. Tell us more about him and what he brings, what makes him different from Marine Le Pen?
Oh, well, he's very, very, very close to her. I mean, he's even like living with his niece. I mean, it's kind of family story somehow. He always admired her a lot. He entered Front National when he was 17. And he is really one of his aides, you know, his men, one of his men supporting the party. So you could somehow say he's kind of a projection of Marine Le Pen. He has the same ID. He's not contesting really her line. And well, he speaks very easily. He's very at ease in debates. He looks very urban. So, and he's so young. You know, he was elected European MP. He was one of the youngest. So this is like, let's say, the nice, refreshed, but that's a way to talk, face of the party, but with the same ideas than Marine Le Pen.
Well, the way you describe him there, it almost reminds one of, frankly, Emmanuel Macron, not from the policies, but just being the sort of fresh, young face of French politics. By comparison, I mean, just at the end, can we talk about Emmanuel Macron as well? He's clearly not the fresh face anymore. The fact that the far right is doing so well, I mean, is that really about their fresh face or is it about the failures of Emmanuel Macron himself?
I would say this is his worst nightmare, you know, Emmanuel Macron's worst nightmare, that his policy or his whole theory of being neither right nor left, you know, of having some take some ideas from the right and many others from the left would eventually, you know, be a kind of balance and would please everybody. Now, obviously, people are more and more, you know, he's not that unpopular, by the way. And it's not to say that the game is over and his party will disappear from the political landscape. But definitely lots of people are angry with him, unsatisfied, and that opens really a large avenue for extremists on the right or on the left.
Florence Biedermann, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio, and I'm Chris Chermak. Now it's time for a look at the day's international newspapers with Robin Brandt, former BBC China correspondent. He joins me right here in studio. Good afternoon.
Hello. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. Let's start with something you discussed on this show actually last week, but China, where the National People's Congress has been wrapping up. I'm curious particularly of how kind of the region has been covering it. You spoke last time about the economic side of China, but what about, you know, noises about Taiwan, South China Sea, all of that? How was that covered?
Well, the Two Sessions is an annual event. It's a hugely important, highly choreographed gathering of about 3,000 legislators, celebrities, high-profile politicians and military figures. So it comes round every year. It's watched very astutely, most importantly within China's borders by its 1.4 billion people. It is a hugely predictable event usually. And so for news followers and journalists like us, it can be an interesting event because you often know what you're going to get. There's very rarely anything outside of the lines in terms of unpredictable events. And this year hasn't been an exception to that. But what we have had in terms of the event wrapping up in Beijing today is it's quite clear that the ongoing, continuing trend within China's leadership, known as Zhongnanhai, which kind of means Middle South Sea, that's where the leadership are located in Beijing, is that Xi Jinping's dominance, and dominance is the right word there, continues. And his role at the very head of the party, at the head of government, at the head of the country, continues to be strengthened. And that is reflected in much of of the reporting that we're seeing about the two sessions as it wrapped up today. We're reading about new laws that have been passed to make it easier and give even more control over some of the political jobs in government to the Communist Party of China. And the concept of the Communist Party and government is one that's very different in China than it is to what maybe we're used to in our Western liberal democracies. We've heard much talk about national security. That is at the very centre now of the whole ethos behind China's ruling Communist Party and Xi Jinping into his third term.
Well, and one other aspect of that, just to ask you about, when you say it's all choreographed, not many surprises, but language does matter. And one that I understand was slightly different was they sort of dropped a reference to peaceful reunification with Taiwan. And perhaps that's also not really a surprise given where things have been going. But what did the region make of that?
Yeah, I think you're right. The words are hugely important. I spoke with a colleague of yours a few days ago about China's target in terms of its ongoing economic growth. And we had 5%, but we had the word before that of around 5%. And that is hugely important. And you're right, words are very important. They're chosen very assiduously in terms of what they're meant to mean to the audience. But I think you're right. The dropping of that word is a reflection of where we are. Perhaps not more aggressive, but more assertive approach from China, from the People's Liberation Army, from its Navy, from its Air Force. And we've seen over the last year it being far more bothersome. I suppose that's actually a huge understatement in terms of what that language is like, in terms of its incursions into Taiwan's independent airspace, and making it quite clear that it wants to become it wants to harass Taiwan's government and harass its military even more. And it is a very stated, a clear aim of Xi Jinping and his government, maybe as early as 2027, to see Taiwan reunified, as they describe it, with the motherland. But words are very important. But make no mistake, in that whole region, crossing even further east to the United States, there is no doubt that there is an increasing chance of a military confrontation. What people fear most is an accidental military incursion, an accidental military confrontation. But the last year alone has seen a far more tension and far more unpredictable events in terms of those possible military confrontations in and around the Taiwan Strait and close to the island itself.
Well, let's move over to the United States, because you've been also following the campaign, the presidential campaign there. It's been getting increasingly ugly. And of course, we still have a whole 9 months of this to go.
Yeah, we do. I sense an enthusiasm in your
voice
there.
Extremely. Did you notice?
Just 9 months to go. I think it's fascinating to look at events in Georgia over the weekend when both President Biden and Donald Trump, the presumptive candidates for their respective parties now, were speaking. Georgia, of course, a key swing state in the coming election in November. And look, we know that Donald Trump's style of campaigning, his style of government, can be quite nasty. It can be very personal, whether they are business competitors or whether they are political opponents. And in a speech in Georgia on Sunday, he mocked once again President Biden's stammer. And this is a condition that Joe Biden's had to deal with since he was younger. I was reading a longer profile of him over the weekend in The New Yorker, how he talked about practicing in front of a mirror when he was much younger and reading Irish poetry as a way of trying to get over his stammer. But that shows you how Donald Trump intends to continue exactly in the vein that we expect. His campaigning, his attacks can be very, very personal. It also reminds us that presentation, particularly for Joe Biden, who, let's be frank, it's quite clear him and those around him are not doing well enough in terms of the messaging on their successes, particularly when it comes to the economy. And that is something they need to come to grips with. But also it makes us think about authenticity, I think. Authenticity of politicians, our political leaders, and the extent to which people like Joe Biden want to deal with these impediments, for some people their disabilities, but in a way as well, they want to be open about them. They want to remain true to the kind of people they are and not become something that's distinctly very, very different to the person they are. But nonetheless, you know, just a reminder that this is going to be a nasty, very personal campaign, certainly from the Republican side.
And we will certainly have plenty more on that. But let's just also look quickly at the UK. You've been following the newspapers here as well. The Times particularly is looking at what, you know, there will be elections potentially this year still here in the UK as well. The Times is looking at what a Labour government might look like.
Oh, yeah, and also what it will govern like, possibly. If that election comes maybe in October of this year, as now seems increasingly likely, and Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, who the polls suggest is going to be the UK's next Prime Minister, is touching on kind of significant reforms at the very centre and at the very top of government in terms of slimming down the decision-making process. And the Times tells us that Starmer wants to govern with, quote, a gang of four. So four people at the very heart of government, a kind of executive committee within the cabinet. Now, look, this is familiar. Those who were, remember, the coalition government here between 2010 and 2015 will know that the Prime Minister, his Chancellor, and on the Liberal Democrat side, the leader and the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Dan Alexander, that was known as the Quad, four people that made those decisions, those key decisions in terms of vision and strategy. That was more because it was a marriage of two different parties. This idea is more about having transparency in terms of what government is achieving, clearer decision-making as well, and also dealing with the factionalism and the kind of court nature at the heart of UK central government. I mean, 32 people currently attend the cabinet. It happens once a week, the Prime Minister at the heart of that. This is the body that's supposed to make these key decisions in terms of, you know, spending rules, departmental budget priorities. And Labour, it would seem, think that is problematic. Tony Blair did something similar. He had a delivery unit. There's talk as well of Keir Starmer wanting that. So these are not particularly new radical ideas, but it's yet fresh evidence of increasingly Labour getting closer to what it hopes would be the prospect of being the next government in this country, with Keir Starmer at the helm of that, and coming up with and publicising more practical ideas to make changes, to make reforms. And in this instance, that's in the way that the very centre, the very heart of government make decisions, and who makes those decisions as well. Who will be in the gang of four? Well, Keir Starmer, it would suggest, according to this Times report, it will be him, the party's deputy leader, the Chancellor, if they make it, and a man called Pat McFadden. Not many people outside of Westminster might know who he is, but he increasingly could be a very influential person in a future Labour government in terms of delivery and a power broker within the government itself.
Robin Brand, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally, on today's show, we can't really get away from one more round of Oscars ceremony coverage, particularly because we can now be joined by our senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco from Sao Paulo. Fernando, did you manage to watch the entire thing? Was there a watch party over there in Brazil?
Absolutely, Chris. Going back to tradition, in fact, because my first Oscars was back in 1993. I think I was only 7 to 8 years old. I remember going to bed quite late at that time. But yes, it's a big topic all around the world. I mean, the Brazilian papers covering, and it's funny, there was not even any Brazilian film or even, you know, a Brazilian kind of actor or kind of, you know, so, but there's still a lot of interest to the event here in Brazil, Chris.
Is there a different flavor to it over there when you're watching compared to being here in the UK or in the US for that matter?
Well, to be honest, actually, it's much better watching from Brazil time-wise because it's a bit closer to the US. So, you know, it just finished around 11:30 p.m. here. It felt very good. And I think, you know, we have a good coverage here as well. There were proper kind of film critics doing the coverage. I know in some other countries, I mean, there's been some criticism here and there in the way they report the Oscars. But, you know, thumbs up here from the Brazilian coverage.
Well, and before we get to the films and who won and who lost, what did you make of the fashion and the fashion malfunctions, for that matter?
Well, there's been great fashion, I have to say. But yes, I mean, I think when you mention fashion malfunction, I mean, Emma Stone winning Best Actress, poor her, had a lovely Louis Vuitton dress. But I think when she went to the stage, the zipper was broken. But, you know, she made fun of it. She said, well, I was dancing along to one of the performances, which I'm sure we'll be talking a bit later here on this check-in as well. But Chris, if you ask me, the highlights from fashion, Carrie Mulligan, super elegant, wearing Balenciaga, Common Domingo with Louis Vuitton as well. He was wearing some slightly flary trousers. Not everyone can pull that off. But I think Coleman Domingo did very, very well.
Well, we will hear about a little bit later about what caused that broken zipper. But first, yeah, let's hear from the big winners of the night.
I have to go to the envelope for that. And I will. Here it comes. And Maria, I see Oppenheimer. Yes. Yes, Emma Thomas, Charles Roman.
What happened? What a strange announcement from Al Pacino to begin with, Faye.
That was quite funny. I mean, but to be honest, Chris, we're getting used to those confused veterans, you know, showcasing the best picture. I mean, think of 2017 with the mix-up between Moonlight and La La Land, which I think we can kind of blame on Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway. But yeah, you know, Al Pacino, he looked like he was not too bothered, you know.
he didn't really care that Oppenheimer won. He just sort of threw it out there.
At least he mentioned the right film. I think that's a very important thing to do.
Were you more excited by the fact that Oppenheimer won, or were you kind of hoping that somebody else might steal the show at the last minute?
You know what, Chris? Oppenheimer was not my favorite film of the year, but it was the clear favorite. And I'm glad, because it's important for Hollywood, because I was looking at the numbers. I think since 2004, when Lord of the Rings Return of the King won Best Picture, you didn't see a film as big winning Best Picture. And when I say as big, look at Oppenheimer. The box office was almost $1 billion. The critics loved it. The public loved it. I think this is important for the Academy. You know, we all have our indie favorites. That's very important. And I think the Oscars did very well in the last years to, you know, to award those smaller films. But let's be honest, the ratings have been gone down a little bit as well. So I have a feeling that this year, you know, you had a lot of talks of Barbie, you have Oppenheimer. It was well-deserved. 7 Oscars for Oppenheimer, even though it's not my favorite. It's a technically brilliant film. It's a good film. I can't say anything too bad about it.
Well, and you did touch on there the fact that the public also particularly loved another film, which was really reflected in the entertainment for the show, the Oscars, which was quite spectacular. Ryan Gosling and his supporting cast performing I'm Just Ken. Here, let's hear a little of that.
I'm just Ken. Anywhere else I'd be told, is it my destiny to live down a life of love for truth? I'm just Ken, where I see love, she sees a friend.
Faye, Barbie was the entertaining highlight with that, but not particularly award-winning.
Yes, no, but you know, but Barbie was very much present at the ceremony, and Ryan Gosling performing I'm Just Ken, that was pure entertaining. You know, it was so fun to watch it. I think that was definitely one of the highlights for me. And you know what, Chris? It didn't win Best Original Song. I think that went for Billie Eilish, also with another song from the Barbie movie. You know, it's fine. I know there's been some controversies. You know, Greta Gerwig wasn't nominated for Best Director. But I think the Barbie team should be happy because there were so many jokes about Barbie. The whole ceremony was surrounded by Barbie. Although it was not the winner, it was very much present at the ceremony. And Ryan Gosling, I mean, he could be a singer, for God's sake. We need good male singers these days. He could be a contender, you know what?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, well, finally, one other aspect, Fernand, I want to ask you about. The best documentary went to 20 Days in Mariupol. I was just wondering what your sense of kind of how politics entered this ceremony. It's always something that is kind of present along with the entertainment.
Well, just look at the beginning of the show. The whole ceremony was delayed by 5 minutes. That's, you know, I think it's one of the first times that happened, perhaps because some pro-Palestine protesters were blocking roads. So some celebrities were arriving a little bit delayed. So they decided on that. So it started already kind of political. But yes, you mentioned 20 Days in Mariupol. That was one of the most kind of emotional and chilling speeches of the night. Director Mstislav Chernov, he said he wished he never made the film. And he was not the only one who became political. I think Jonathan Glazer as well for the Zone of Interest. He's a Jewish man himself. He said that in his speech, but he was calling for an end to the attacks in Gaza as well. I mean, I think celebrities these days are very cautious to say anything political, especially when they're winning an award, because, you know, the whole world is divided. I don't think they want any type of controversy. But there were some political speeches, but I think they were all you know, very well made. I don't think there's anything controversial about that in a way. It's the world we live in. And I think the Oscars, they kind of have to reflect that. We need the entertainment of Barbie, but we also, you know, we need films and documentaries like 20 Days in Mariupol.
And just finally, Fernando, before we let you go, anything else that really struck you, surprised you? Was there an award that you were particularly happy about or a performance? What really got you going?
Well, Anatomy of a Fall, Chris. I think you knew that this was one of my favorite. Justine Triet, she won for Best Original Screenplay, which is quite rare. It's a French film. It's my favorite. And the dog in the film, Messi, he attended the ceremony. There was some controversy, can he attend or not? There was a lot of talks in there. But I mean, that dog, I mean, it deserved every single award because he was so good. It was an Oscar-worthy performance. If you see the film, you know what I'm talking about. Very smart dog. And he was there among the crowd as well.
I'm glad the Oscars are joining Monocle here at our offices, Midori House, also very dog-friendly. Fernando, thank you very much. That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that is all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Lillian Fawcett and Christy O'Grady. Our studio manager was Mariela Bevan. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.